The big debate in America this summer isn't Obama versus McCain, free trade versus protectionism, or the Boston Red Sox versus the New York Yankees. It's the digital literacy debate, the debate about whether or not the internet is killing reading. So writes our guest this hour on his blog, and that is the question we will discuss this hour. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we will wonder if the internet is killing the American reader. Are you reading fewer books these days because maybe you're spending more time on the internet? How about your kids or grandkids? Have they read a book all summer? Some are blaming the internet for this, and we'll wonder what you think and what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Are we, as a culture, reading less because of the internet? Our guest is Andrew Keene, author of The Cult of the Amateur, now out in paperback, and the author of a blog article, The Great Seduction, Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Hi, Joey. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for being with us. So who started this debate?
Well, I think this debate's really been going on ever since there's been technology. There's always been the idea that technology undermines our ability to read. I think that this most recent round of the debate was started by Nicholas Carr, the very distinguished East Coast technology critic who wrote a cover story for the Atlantic Monthly magazine for the summer, which was headlined, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And Carr makes a really interesting argument that the latest version of internet technology, the self-authoring technology of blogs, is resulting in us spending more and more time superficially browsing the internet and failing to have an ability to actually invest our minds seriously in detailed textual analysis. So the internet allows us to skim. We're becoming a nation of skimmers. We read things very quickly. We read short pieces. We read blog posts. We read headlines. But we're increasingly incapable of getting our teeth, to use an inappropriate metaphor, into a book.
Yeah, we're not reading War and Peace.
We're certainly not reading War and Peace. And some of the supporters of the internet actually think that's a good thing. There's a guy called Clay Shirky who teaches at New York University. He's one of the most utopian of internet backers. And he's written, Carr and myself had a big debate on the Encyclopedia Britannica website about all this. And Carr said that he thought it was a good thing, that War and Peace was way too long, and the fact that that no one was reading it anymore reflected the fact that it was an irrelevant book. So from Shirky's point of view, the fact that we're not reading War and Peace is a good thing. Of course, from Carr's point of view, and indeed from my point of view, it's a bad thing. It's a worrying thing.
Yeah. Well, besides, just people wondering if this is the case, do we have any evidence that it is the case that the internet is killing the American reader?
Well, the book industry in America is not in as bad a state as the music business or the newspaper business, but it's not in a good state. I was in London last month. I did a speech at a conference for all the top publishers in England called Digitalize or Die. And they all recognize the same thing, that unless they can figure out how to distribute their products on the internet, they are going to experience the same fate as the music business, the big labels, which are literally dying. So we're buying more books than we're buying CDs. We're buying more books than we're buying newspapers. But that isn't saying much. The book business is certainly not healthy. And booksellers are struggling to promote their products. And the retail business is in profound crisis. More and more independent bookstores are shutting. Barnes & Noble is in crisis. So Amazon's doing pretty well. But Amazon is becoming the dominant bookseller, which in many people's minds is a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with us doing reading, skimming on the internet as opposed to buying a book at Barnes & Noble?
Well, in my opinion, I'm not against the internet. My book, The Cult of the Amateur, is not a Luddite book, and I don't think Carr is either. I mean, we like technology, we use it, we think that the internet is a healthy development in terms of communication. So it's not necessarily an either-or. But I do think that the inability to focus is a profound problem, particularly for the younger generation, what we call now the YouTube generation, these kids who are growing up on the internet. Because it's one thing to write a blog post, and in 300, 400, 500 words, one can say some interesting things. But to really develop a serious argument, I know this myself as an author of a book and as an author of blog posts, one can do so much more in a book. And if I can't grab people's attention over 200, 300, 400 pages, then I'm not really able to articulate really serious arguments. So what concerns me is I can grab people's attention for 30 seconds, for a couple of hundred words, but that doesn't mean that I'm able to expand their mind. So, you know, in very, very simple terms, I think my concern, Carr's concern, a lot of psychologists, reading experts' concerns, is that we're becoming superficial. The shorter the pieces we read, the more a nation of skimmers we become, the more superficial we are, the more unable we are to actually grasp serious ideas, whether they're in the arts or the sciences.
And this is particularly troubling, you say, with the younger generation, which is...
Absolutely. I mean, there's a book that's just been written called The Dumbest Generation by an Emory University professor called Mark Bauerlein, who explicitly says, look, this is really a generational problem. I touch on this in my book. Carr touches on it in his article. But Bauerlein's book is the most sort of explicit articulation of this position, that anyone under 30 is simply not able to concentrate anymore. There's another book out, another very interesting book, by the Boston Globe columnist Maggie Jackson, called Distracted. And she talks about this generation that is so distracted by our electronic toys, by our inability to pay attention to anything seriously, that we're on the verge of what she calls a dark age. She even raises the year 451, the year when the Goths took Rome. They were on the verge of a new Middle Ages, of a period when the lights go out and we lose a sense of our own civilization.
Yeah. In fact, the New York Times had a front page article that we noticed about a week or so ago that first piqued our interest in doing a program like this. And in searching around for some information, that's when I came upon on your blog. And this the New York Times is going to be running a series on.
Yeah,
on
the New York Times is, as the New York Times, you know, and the New York Times is a very good newspaper, and they invested a 3,500 word piece laying out the different positions, and they're going to run a whole series. What was interesting in last Sunday's New York Times, they had a piece about trolls on the internet and the violence and the anonymity. I mean, this goes beyond reading. It's a broader cultural question of how people not only are becoming superficial on the internet, but are also misbehaving. They're lacking any kind of morality. But I do think that this issue of reading is a very profound one. There's a brain expert, a neuroscientist in the UK, who makes the argument that all this technology is changing the shape of our brains. So it's not really a moral argument. It's not necessarily that we're becoming lazier or more stupid. The biggest problem may be that our brains are changing, that as human beings, physiologically, all this technology is altering who we are, which makes us into skimmers rather than readers. And one could argue, if one wanted to sound a little bit like a conservative, that the books are indeed central to Western civilization. And if you take them away, then what do you have left? I take that position. I mean, in my mind, the books are the central exhibit in our history, in our civilization. They are... They reflect us at our best. It doesn't mean that all of us are able to write books, but all of us are able to read and appreciate books.
We are talking with Andrew Keen. He is author of a book, The Cult of the Amateur, now out in paperback. He's also the author of the blog article, The Great Seduction, Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? And that's what we are asking this hour. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Tuesday, August the 5th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Coming up after 5, Ben will talk with the author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. That's coming up after 5 this afternoon. We're talking about whether we as a culture are reading less and reading fewer books because of the internet. We are exploring this question and the implications of it with Andrew Keen, author of The Cult of the Amateur and the blog article, The Great Seduction, Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? We welcome your thoughts and questions, maybe even your own experiences. Are you reading fewer books? Do you credit or blame the internet for your reading habits? Nelda in Appleton is our first caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, and hello to your guests. I couldn't agree with you more. I am a children's librarian, and I've traditionally worked in schools, and I guess what I see so disturbing about this trend is, first of all, that the things that have traditionally been important in terms of educating children in using books is no longer important. What I have to do with the very youngest is teach them how to point and click correctly, as opposed to identify their favorite authors, or perhaps become familiar with some of what we might call more traditional children's stories, children's literature. And I think a lot of that has to do with parents wanting their kids to have an edge, and they don't necessarily value the edge that books provide in terms of education. Also, a disturbing trend, at least in Wisconsin, there are less and less and less librarians in elementary schools, which is the most important time for teaching kids how to use books and to become excited about what can be gleaned from books as opposed to the superficial sort of information you get from the internet. And finally, my last comment is, I guess, as a librarian, watching people walk around Barnes & Noble and use Amazon.com, what disturbs me about that so much is that without somebody trained, for example, a librarian, to guide them correctly to the information they might need or help them ferret through their thoughts and determine what it is that they really do want, people buy a lot of books that maybe aren't what they were looking for. Amazon and Barnes & Noble aren't set up to help you find the information you need. They're set up to help you buy more books. Yeah. And I think that makes a big, big difference in how people access information, find information, and ultimately don't find information. And I will listen tough at the air.
You're a great spokesperson for librarians, Nelda. Andrew Keen?
Absolutely. Yeah. I 100% agree with everything Nelda says. She's absolutely right. Librarians are enormously valuable. And one of the problems with this latest technology revolution, what's called Web 2.0, is that we're supposed to applaud the fact that the valuable intermediaries, whether they're librarians or bookstores or journalists or writers, are being done away with and replaced by the author as audience. So the audience, we all now become authors. Readers can write books. We don't need experts to lead us anywhere. And I think Nelda's absolutely right. Google is a problem here as well, in the sense that Google is replacing librarians. And what people don't understand is that Google isn't a public service. Google is a massive money-making operation, which is selling billions of dollars worth of advertising. In itself isn't a bad thing, but librarians are way more valuable than Google. When a kid goes onto Google to do a search, they're not getting any human wisdom. They're getting the supposed wisdom, although it's not very wise, of something called an artificial algorithm, artificial intelligence. Librarians can never be replaced. I'm calling from California, which I would guess is in a much worse state in terms of libraries than Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But everywhere around America, you have this same crisis of the wise human being, whether it's the librarian or the bookstore owner or even the writer who is being disintermediated by this technological revolution. And librarians are a group of people who have responded particularly enthusiastically to my book and my argument.
I think our libraries are still doing well. We love our libraries in Wisconsin. A while back, Madison had a moniker of having the most used library system in the country, but I think that's changing to some extent.
And I
too.
Think that the other point that the librarian made, which is also important, is that whilst it's good to teach kids about technology, it's not a bad thing. You're not teaching them just because they can access the internet doesn't make them wise. So certainly teaching children to read still, in my mind, is the most valuable weapon in terms of making them smart and making them competitive in this economy. They've got to learn to read. They've got to be able to concentrate. And that's the problem with all this technology, is it tends to be most seductive when it comes to the more vulnerable in society, particularly the youngest amongst us, who have no defense against the mesmerizing quality of all this technology. And, of course, they're not using it to read online. They're not using it to read the New York Times or the Atlantic, which are very valuable. They're using it to play video games.
Nelda, thank you so much for the call. Lynn in Stevens Point is with us now. Good morning. Lynn now must have stepped away from his or her telephone. Let me put Lynn back on hold and share an email that we received from Susan in Heartland. I love going to the library or Barnes & Noble. It is a comfort for me to have a good book, some coffee in hand, at home or at the coffee shop. The internet is not, in my opinion, here for us to read a novel. It is for quick information, email and chat rooms. Just want to comment on that. It's just not the same reading.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. I think what we've all got to remember, and this is the same as the music business, is that in order to support the book business, whether it's retail or writers, we've got to buy books. So sometimes people say to me, well, what can we do? All these things are inevitable. It's not going to make any difference. What we can all do as individuals is buy books if we can. Now, if we really don't have any cash, obviously we can go to the libraries. But one of the problems with being a writer, I know this firsthand, is that as consumers spend more and more money online and don't buy books, of course it shrivels up the market and it makes it increasingly difficult for writers to earn a living.
Now, Lynn in Stevens Point is there. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just calling to comment that I'm thinking that it's tragic in my mind that the people are talking in sound bites and really fragmented and there's no continuity just even in conversation between people, even intimate like couples. And I think children, when they're raised with in front of a computer or a TV, their brain, the structure of their brain isn't allowed to grow in the way that it's supposed to. And it's really, I see it all the time from like the kids in Head Start all the way up to adulthood. I was just wondering if you have any comment about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this is a national crisis in some levels. I think many parents understand this. I think one of the problems with America is it's not recognized as such. In the UK, in England, it's recognized as a crisis. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, recognized the fact that there needed to be a serious focus on the impact of the internet on children and on families. And he commissioned a report called the Byron Review that was published earlier this year, which in very, very serious detail investigated the impact of the internet on children's education and online safety. And it was a bipartisan report that brought industry, charities, nonprofits, children, parents, and government together. I think a similar thing needs to happen in America. It doesn't mean that we're in favor of switching off the internet or censoring it or limiting it. The internet is a good thing. But I do think that one of the problems is that a lot of parents don't understand the internet, and their kids know more than they do, and parents are maybe embarrassed or bamboozled or too busy to concentrate on this. Parents need help in terms of figuring out how to manage their children's use of the internet. Teachers need help as well. And I think that the children's education in technology needs to take place in families, in the classroom. And at the moment in America, for the most part, that isn't happening. And the only way that this can change is if there are more governmental initiatives. It doesn't mean that the government clamps down or tells people what they have to do. But I do think that we need a lead here from senior statesmen, and it's not happening in America, and it is happening in Europe.
Thanks to Lynn. Kathy in Richland County is our next caller. Good morning.
Hi. I'd like to throw out just another possibility. I think that a lot of what's going on is maybe more of a stylistic thing that's bothering the older generation than it is an ability to think or even a hesitation to read books. I'm part of that older generation that values language and that values beauty in language, I think. My sons, though, are part of that younger computer generation. In fact, my two youngest sons both work on the internet and are very involved in that whole milieu, and I used to really worry about that. What I see with them, though, now that they're in their 20s, is that they both do read books. They read a lot of books. One of them reads them on a portable kind of book machine, but they both read books, and they both are very deep thinkers and very, very good conversationalists and very good arguers. What they value, though, when they're looking at an argument and when they're going into depth in an argument, is concision and precision of language, more than the elegance of the language. And I find myself almost feeling like sometimes that I'm arguing for the Palmer penmanship, method of writing, that, like the older generation when I was their age was saying, well, people are, using typewriters too much and whatever, and beautiful penmanship has gone out the window, and now I'm saying, beautiful language is going out the window. And I wonder, how much of what we're being bothered with is the style more than the reality of things.
Good question, Andrew.
It's a fair point. In Nicholas Carr's Atlantic article, he uses the example of Friedrich Nietzsche, the late 19th century German philosopher. What happened, Carr argues, with Nietzsche is that the use of the typewriter, when Nietzsche started using the typewriter, which is really an early example, I guess, of the keyboard and the computer, is that his style became much shorter, more aphoristic. So he went from writing longer books to a more aphoristic, punchier style. Now, in my mind, that actually made Nietzsche a better writer, because I think we tend to remember his aphorisms more than his longer books. The problem, of course, is that most of us aren't Nietzsche. So whilst there are a few people online who have mastered that aphoristic style and do it extremely well, the majority of people go on services like Twitter, which are now called microblogs, where you're supposed to broadcast your thoughts in 20 or 30 words to the world. And most of us don't make any sense, and we tend to ruin language, misspell words. So the problem is that this is a new art form, I acknowledge, and it can be done well, but the majority of people are doing it, I think, more like apes, more in a grunting way than a way that actually does credit to the human condition.
Andrew Keene, our guest. We are talking about his article, The Great Seduction: Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? Andrew Keene, also the author of the book, The Cult of the Amateur, now out in paperback. And our next caller is Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. My question comment is along the following line. I have two boys, age 14 and 13. The 14-year-old is an avid reader. He reads everything he can get his hands on. He's on the internet also a lot, doing research and things of that nature. The other boy is a very poor reader, poor in the sense that he doesn't read books, but he's on the internet all the time doing research and video games. Now, they both come from the same household. Everything is exactly the same for them as far as opportunities. but one just has a natural tendency one way and the other one has a natural tendency the other. What I try to teach them is no matter which way you go, the most important thing is focus, to be able to focus on the problem at hand.
Yep. So you're not too concerned about the boy who doesn't do so much reading, Mike?
Not really, because I think his, you know, the way his he's put together is just different than the other boy. They're both equally bright. They're both, you know, they have very good conversation, very good vocabulary. They just look at things differently.
Are you worried, Andrew Keene, about his younger son?
Well, I don't know his younger son. He sounds a very concerned parent. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the issues is the way in which, as I said earlier, is the way in which parents are dealing with this. Now, this gentleman sounds a serious parent who's observing what his kids, his sons are both doing on the internet. And I think he's, you know, his point's a fair one. I mean, just because you don't read doesn't make you stupid. Books aren't the sole criteria for determining intelligence. But I do think that when one chooses not to read books, one is switching oneself off to a deeper kind of intelligence, an ability to, as I said, sink into more complex argument. The same may be true in terms of us stopping watching movies. You see everything becoming shorter on the internet, whether it's books or movies, rather than watching 90-minute movies now, we're watching 3-minute movies on YouTube. Rather than watching or reading long articles, New York Times articles about reading in newspapers, we're reading headlines. So this is a question of attention more than anything else. And I think if you're unable to focus, that will ultimately result in doing harm to you, I think, as a thinking human being and as a working person, because focus is the heart of anything, whatever one's doing, whether it's science or work or parenting or relationships.
Bevan Ford Atkinson emails, I think children should have the classics presented to them. I remember reading so many of those books on summer days when it was too hot to move. I also believe there are many new children's books that merit reading. My gifts to children are almost always a book. Do you think that'll help, or what will help Andrew Keene in getting kids to read more books or the classics?
Well, I think certainly giving books to children is a wonderful gift. You know, I've got a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I'll always take them to the bookstore. I won't take them to the toy store, and I certainly won't invest in video games for them. Again, I think it comes down to responsible parenting and to not banning the internet or banning video games, because I think that that's equally unhealthy, but understanding that children need to be managed. Children can't be allowed to do anything they like on the internet. Now, there's obviously the issue of children's safety online as well, but this is a medium that needs parental involvement. And many parents, I think, as I suggested, feel inadequate because they don't understand the internet. And I think parents have a responsibility to put computers in their living room, to understand what their kids are doing online, to put parental locks on the computers so they can't go anywhere on the internet. Any parent who says to me, well, we're thrilled that our kids are using the internet, we don't really understand it ourselves, and we just let them do anything they like, I think are behaving irresponsibly. And any parent who doesn't encourage children to read, I think are also irresponsible, whether it means taking them to the library or buying them books. As the gentleman suggested earlier, you can't force kids to read, and some children just don't want to read. But you want to encourage it. You want to put books in front of children. You want to make sure that they have the opportunity to read. I mean, I came across what to me was a really disturbing statistic. 57% of people in America never read a book in a year. So that means that more than 5 out of 10 people never read a single book in a year. Now, in my mind, that is a criminal statistic. Everyone has a responsibility to at least read one book a year. Who are these people who are not reading a single book? What are they doing with their time?
Yeah, I bet you they're not public radio listeners, because I know public radio listeners love to read. Most of our audience, though, a little bit older, so it'd be interesting to hear if anybody in the younger generation is listening and wants to chime in on this. Do you think the internet has affected your reading? Do you read fewer books because of the time you spend or spent on the internet? 1-800-642-1234. We welcome all of your thoughts and questions about whether the internet is killing the American reader. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Andrew Keene. He is author of The Cult of the Amateur, now out in paperback, and also the author of this article on his blog that we're talking about this hour, The Great Seduction, Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. It's good to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you. Kathleen and her guest will examine the world oil market and the relationship between expanded offshore drilling, tapping oil reserves, and supply versus demand. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. Tomorrow at this time, by the way, we will talk with the author of the new book, Traffic. We'll talk about what traffic does to our lives and our culture coming up tomorrow at this time. Andrew Keene, our guest this hour, his book, The Cult of the Amateur, his blog article, The Great Seduction, Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? And Bob in Viroqua is our next caller. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy, Andrew. Hi. I'm of the older generation, so I apologize for not being young.
That's okay. We want to hear
from you, too. I'm a prolific reader. I have always been. I read a lot of nonfiction, preferably most of the titles by which I get off of WPR. We have five kids, ages 7 through 17, and our expectation of them is that once a week they go to the library and pick up books that they want to read, and they read them, but they also are allowed their electronic toys. Question I have basically is, it's my feeling that the lack of reading has sort of impaired what creativity and critical thinking in a lot of the younger people. Am I wrong in that assessment?
Andrew?
I'm not sure. I mean, that's a pretty dramatic statement. I think that there is creativity, but it's in different ways. I think that certainly, you know, when it comes to video games, this younger generation is very creative, both in using it and in creating new ones. I think this younger generation is articulate, is able to use the new technology, cell phones, blogging, instant messaging, microblogging. But the problem, again, is one of concentration. Problem is this generation unable to actually focus on things for more than a few minutes? And I would have to conclude, I do it in my book and a number of other books and articles I think are supporting what I'm saying, is that this younger generation is incapable of really paying attention in serious detail to things, whether they're political or economic or cultural. And in that sense, I think we're in crisis. It is a generational issue. Perhaps it's not surprising that most of your callers are older.
Mm-hmm.
If we got, it'd be interesting to have a caller from under 30 on and see what their opinion is. I speak around the country, and I tend to find that there's a very profound generational divide. The people under 30 are very hostile to what I'm saying.
They
think that their generation is actually doing well. They think that video games is actually enriching, that it's not a problem not to read. And the books, for the most part, don't have much value.
I do have a caller. I'm not sure he's under 30, but Tom in Barron joins us and self-identified himself as being of the younger generation. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I'm 21, so
okay.
I guess I'm kind of in there.
Yeah, so what do you think?
I do believe that the internet actually enriches the opportunity. It's a little bit, I would place it a little bit better than books. I know that books have their own value, and I used to read a lot when I was a kid back before I was kind of brought up on the internet, too. My dad got a computer right away. But I think that the internet opens up a lot of new possibilities, and I'm able to actually keep ahead of the political scene and cultural scene better because the internet is just right there feeding information to me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I can find whatever I'm really looking for.
But you don't focus and you don't concentrate, Tom?
Oh, I focus and concentrate on certain things. I don't have any problem focusing and concentrating, I don't believe.
Yeah, but do you pay attention to details and depth in any way, or are you just kind of scanning stuff? Yeah.
I frequent CNN and a bunch of, well, that's not necessarily a good thing. You have to check your sources all over the place, no matter what you're reading. But I read a lot of things, go a lot of in-depth. I'm able to actually search out more details on the Internet.
Yeah, so how come you don't just pick up a book now and again, Tom?
Oh, I pick up books every once in a while. More, if I'm looking for a book, I do more fantasy things. I just find relevant information to be more attainable on the Internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't sound like Tom's in crisis. Andrew Keene, what do you think?
Well, Tom sounds an intelligent young man, although I think he does, as you say, Joy, I think it wouldn't do him any harm to occasionally pick up a book. I think what he's talking about is what I would call an always-on society, where he's focused not so much on in-depth knowledge, but on information. So he uses the Internet to find out up to the second what's going on. And the Internet is good for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than television. It's better than the radio. The information is continually being changed, whether one's on CNN.com or the blogosphere or Wikipedia. But I'm not sure whether that necessarily is making him any wiser. It makes him more current. It's intoxicating and seductive to be always up to the minute, up to the second informed about what's going on. But it tends, in my mind, to be rather superficial. It might be more valuable to read a history book about American politics, to give himself some perspective. The problem with the Internet is it doesn't give us any distance. And people like Tom are skipping from website to website and from headline to headline. And most of that stuff is forgettable. It's not educating him. It's not making him more knowledgeable about American politics. He won't be able to place the Obama or the McCain campaigns or this election in the context of previous campaigns or in the context of broader issues in American politics and society. All he'll be able to do is tell you what's actually happening up to the minute, up to the second. And I'm not sure whether that has any value. Now, this shows that what the Internet really is an outgrowth of television culture. I see my book and all these arguments as being the next chapter in people like Neil Postman's critique of television. What the Internet is becoming is a speeded-up version of television, a speeded-up version of CNN. All it does is focus on the moment, and it doesn't give us any ability to reflect.
Yeah. Do you want to, Tom, challenge our guest or follow up at it in any way?
Well, he has some good points there on some history things, but there are a lot of history, and you can go more in-depth on things. I've used Wikipedia to delve into the past of different issues. I'll hear about an issue, and I'll be able to research it further and figure out its relativity. There's a lot of people updating all the time, and a lot of these people are really intelligent, knowledgeable people, and they can give their two cents on what's going on and how this might point in a different direction based on the past.
Well, that's a fair point that Tom makes, although I'm not sure if he's aware of it, and certainly many people aren't aware of the fact that Wikipedia, which is the free online encyclopedia, has no formal editors. No one's really in control. Anyone can write anything on Wikipedia, which means that the information on it is very spotty. Some of it's good, but some of it's unreliable, and some of it's absolutely wrong. And there are great holes on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is great for up-to-the-minute stuff, but it's not very good in terms of dealing with historical figures, with figures who are less well-known today. So I would prefer if people use the Internet to rely on something like the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is managed by expert editors and academics and has, again, a sense of perspective rather than this up-to-the-minute, up-to-the-second immediacy.
Thank you very much, Tom, for the call. It's good to have a 21-year-old listening along and calling in. I think we have another younger listener, Jean in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to comment on a couple things. First of all, I've heard Google brought up during the conversation as well as the New York Times. And something that speaks to that is Google's development of iGoogle, where you have the ability to basically create what you want to see when you go to the Google homepage. And I know I have a widget set up on there where I can see articles from the New York Times along with about a dozen other major news outlets. And so if it's an issue of people not taking the time to read those articles, such as ones in the New York Times, I think this opens a lot of doors to people who maybe wouldn't have been able to do that before, maybe because they don't have the resource to have that subscription or the luxury to have the time to be able to go to the library and read their copy of the New York Times. So I think it opens doors to people that may not have had access to those resources before, but still the same resources that you're talking about as things that are that have useful value, give wisdom to people, that sort of thing. So yeah. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the issue of access to these resources that people might not have had before.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Keene?
Well, that's very true, and certainly more people have access to the New York Times, and I don't disagree on some level. I have two responses. Firstly, a lot of people have idealized the Internet as being this great community where we all now can debate the great issues of the day. My fear about the Internet is that it's increasingly becoming an echo chamber. In political terms, for example, it's not a place where conservatives and liberals meet to discuss things. It tends to be a place where you have increasingly left-wing or right-wing websites, and there isn't a lot of interaction. So people go on the Internet not to get a broad opinion of the world, but simply to confirm what they already think, which concerns me. So some people might be using iGoogle intelligently, and I'm all in favor of that, and one can't criticize Google for that. But many people are using services like iGoogle, which are ways of customizing what information you get on the Internet, simply to confirm what they already think. The other problem, and this is a broad problem in terms of newspapers, is that newspapers are in profound crisis, much bigger crisis than the book business. Even the New York Times, the old lady of the news business, is in crisis, losing more and more money. And the problem with the Internet is that the newspapers have to give their information away for free. They're not making the kind of money that they make in print. It's very, very hard for them to generate the kind of income which they have historically been used to generating through print, through paid copies. Now, what this means in the long run, I just had a big article published about this in the English magazine Prospect, is that you're seeing newspapers like the New York Times, which pay their correspondents, who pay serious money to invest in foreign bureaus and a large team of expert journalists, what you're seeing is that being replaced by something like the Huffington Post, which gets celebrity writers working for free. And ultimately, all we're going to be left with is newspapers shut, and we're going to see large metropolitan newspapers shut over the next few years, I guarantee it. The two papers that come to mind are the San Francisco Chronicle, my local paper, and the Los Angeles Times. As we see these papers shutting, we're going to see them being replaced by opinion blogs. But the problem is, where are those opinion blogs going to get their reliable information? When we do away with newspapers, when we don't have paid, credible correspondence, information itself becomes very, very unreliable. And that's the ultimate nightmare, is we live in a society without real journalism, without verifiable fact. How are we supposed to find out about the world? How can we become good citizens if we don't know what's happening in the world?
Yeah, we saw this happen in Wisconsin just in the past couple of months, big job cuts at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but also a Madison paper stopped daily publications in favor of the Internet, or it's trying to stay alive on the Internet, and a Superior Wisconsin paper did the same thing just a month or so ago. That's where this is headed.
Yeah, I mean, every newspaper in America is cutting. This has been a catastrophic summer. I wrote a blog piece about it. Thousands of jobs have been laid off this summer, and all the newspaper stocks are in free fall on the stock exchange. It's not a viable business anymore, and you can't blame the Internet for that. And it's great to read reliable content on the internet. I use the internet to read the New York Times, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. But ultimately, it's not a viable medium for serious newspapers. They can't make money out of it in the way they made money out of physical print. And in the long run, this is, I think, a medium which will destroy newspapers. Now, the question is, what will replace them? Will it just be opinion, or will it be something more reliable?
Mark in Vernon County emails, what do you think of Amazon's new Kindle, an electronic book / magazine / newspaper reader? Is this a promising blend of old and new?
I like the idea of the Kindle. The Kindle is an electronic reader. It's the equivalent of the iPod for books. I don't have any problem with buying books online and then reading them on an electronic reader. And if you travel a lot and you don't like carrying around books, it's a good thing. As long as we can avoid the piracy issue in the book business. The problem with the iPod is that most people steal their music online. You can't blame Apple or the iPod for that, but they're using the iPod to listen to stolen music. Now, as long as Amazon and the Kindle can make sure that people aren't pirating books, I'm all in favor of it. I'm all in favor of making books sexier in the sense that young people will say, wow, that's cool. I'd like to get one of those devices and read my stuff on an electronic reader. As long as they do that rather than steal their books or rather than use the Kindle just to look at headlines. So it's a question of concentration. I do worry, though, that the idea of reading a 300 or 400-page book on an electronic reader is a struggle. I personally don't have a Kindle because I like a physical book. I like scrawling in the margins. I like owning something physical. I understand that not everyone's in that camp.
Yeah, we have less than a minute to go, Andrew Keenan. I wanted to know if you think this trend is reversible.
Nothing's inevitable. I think all trends are reversible, but it takes willpower. It takes all of us to be involved. I don't think we can turn this thing around immediately. I think we've all got to recognize is that we create technology. It doesn't create us. We're in charge, and if we don't like what's happening, then we need to act. And I think we have a responsibility, particularly as parents, to understand how our kids are using the internet and to try and shape their use of technology so that they are the masters of technology rather than technology becoming the masters of them.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was fun.
It was. Andrew Keene, author of The Cult of the Amateur, his blog article, The Great Seduction, Is the Internet Killing the American Reader? You can find that at andrewkeene.typepad.com. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, Michelle Kofel, and Rob Ferret for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.